I am a dancer. All right. Actually, it would be better to say I did liturgical dance in seminary. I don't remember how or why I got involved. It was fun. It was another opportunity for me to perform. We danced a few times in chapel and at a couple of churches, but truth be told, I'm no dancer. My heart isn't in it. In a couple of weeks, you'll get to see real dancers in our worship, the same dancers we had on Pentecost. And if you remember how beautiful they danced, or beautifully they danced, it doesn't take much imagination to see why I'm not a dancer. With this body, a power forward, yes. A graceful dancer, not so much. I'm more like an elephant in a tutu. But that isn't such a lovely image, so best we move on. Yes, I could learn some steps, grow in my appreciation of the art, maybe even get my body in shape. But I could never be a dancer. My heart isn't in it. And I give thanks there are people whose hearts are. I share this experience because I think something similar happens in worship. Many of us have been coming to worship forever. But are we truly worshiping? We know the rituals. We say the right words. We appreciate the music. We are moved by the experience. But is our heart in it? Now, it would be judgmental for me to try to answer that question for anyone, any of you in particular. I can't search your hearts. I can only answer the question for myself, as you must answer it for yourself. Only God knows what is on our hearts. But when I have conversations with people about worship, what I hear them speaking about most is not their offering of worship, but their experience of worship. I hear stories of pastors you love whose sermons changed your lives, as well as pastors you didn't love whose sermons were dry as dust. You tell me how singing a hymn that was sung at your mother's funeral still brings you to tears, and how singing another hymn left you cold. Some of you prefer contemporary worship, some traditional, some like to blend. Some of you prefer a praise band. Some of you don't know what you would do without an organ. These are all valid experiences, and I value the conversations. Your feedback helps all of us as worship leaders know how we're being heard and influences how we shape subsequent services of worship. I believe all of the staff would say we are always looking at ways to improve our worship experience, and your feedback is helpful. It's only Angela's second Christmas as director of music, yet we are going to have brass on Christmas Eve because we believe it will enhance our worship experience. But our experience of worship is not the same as our offering of worship. Friends, we are grateful. So many of you have enjoyed the changes we've made to our service of worship. Your appreciation of our attention to the visual arts, the banners, the dancers, the chancel displays. Your recognition of the little changes we have made in our liturgy to keep it fresh and make it flow more freely. Your discovery that you actually like some of the new hymns. And you appreciate our use of music along with the scriptures and the sermons to proclaim God's word. These were important changes, many of them a long time coming, and there will be more in the future. We must continue to strive to provide you the best opportunity to offer your worship we can. But all we can do is impact your experience of worship, not your offering. Your offering of worship is a matter of your heart. Somewhere along the way, worship for too many Christians, at least in America, worship became a commodity. We look at our worship experience and ask, what will I get from worship? Will I find it meaningful? Will I be moved? Will I be fed? Friends, we hear in all these questions the difference between our offering of worship and our experience of worship. For all these questions are about us. And our offering of worship isn't about us. Our experience is about us, yes. And my experience may be different from yours, and your experience may be different from hers. You may like it, I may not. But our experience is not the measure of our worship. The measure of our worship is our devotion to God. The Bible is filled with examples of how we might worship God. The patriarchs would stack stones to mark a place for worship. Here I raise my Ebenezer. God's people worshiped in a tabernacle, a big tent, a temple, synagogues, homes, and eventually churches and cathedrals. In different times and places, their worship included animal sacrifices, music and dancing and silence. The reading of scriptures and the singing of hymns and psalms, preaching and teaching, ritual washing and a common meal. To suggest there is only one right way to worship would be foolish. So rather than engage in arguments over worship style, we are better served spiritually to learn to appreciate worship in all its wondrous forms. We may have personal preferences, but the mystery and the majesty of God is not served when we limit our appreciation for worship to the experiences we find moving or meaningful. Nevertheless, While we should nurture an appreciation for a variety of worship experiences, there is a difference between true worship and false worship. If we ignore this distinction, it is to our peril. For true worship leads to life, and false worship leads to death. Both are a matter of the heart. In our reading from Psalm 95, we see clearly the inspiration for true worship: God's power and God's providence. The psalm's call to worship is all about God. Oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker. For the Lord is our God, and we are the people of God's pasture and the sheep of God's hand. We are called to worship God, not only because God is our Maker and we are God's people, but because God is the creator and sustainer of all creation. The spirit of our worship is to be one of thanksgiving, humility, and joy for the life and care we receive from God as part of God's creation. When our hearts are so inspired, this is true worship. Now, we didn't read it this morning, but the first chapter of Isaiah gives us a wonderful example of what God desires. God says, "What to me is the multitude of your sacrifices? I've had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. I cannot endure solemn assemblies with iniquity. Your new moons and your appointed festivals my soul hates. They have become a burden to me. I am weary of them. When you stretch out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, remove the evil of your doings from before my eyes, cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow." Friends, Isaiah prophesies judgment on God's people because their worship had become meaningless ritual. Their hearts weren't in it. Their sacrifices were abundant, tens of thousands a day. But the lives they were living, filled with injustice and iniquity, especially towards the poor and oppressed, the lives they were living were not pleasing to God. God was angry and heartbroken because they were going through the motions. Their worship was an abomination. Their hearts were not in it. The Pharisees were masters of false worship. Go home and read Matthew 23. They piled layer upon layer of religious rituals and laws upon God's people to hide their lack of faith and corrupt hearts. Jesus rails against them. Hear a little of what he says. Jesus says, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You tithe mint and dill and neglect the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. You clean the outside of the cup and plate, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. You are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside look beautiful, but inside they are full of the bones of the dead and all kinds of filth." Beloved, Jesus doesn't hold back his condemnation of false worship. He knows worship is a matter of life and death. And true worship is a matter of the heart, reflected less in our experience of worship and more in the way we live our lives. Friends, I know you all think you've sat through some dreadful worship services. Maybe some of you are thinking that today. I'm sure you have. But be thankful, you weren't the one leading the worship. Trust me, it's always better to sit through a dreadful worship service. You can let your mind wander, you can make your to-do lists, but the one leading, we're in it for the duration. But in solidarity, let me share with you a little trick I learned a long time ago. And this works whether I'm in the pulpit or in the pew. So it will work for you. If I'm struggling to sing a horrible hymn, like in the garden, or if I'm sitting through or preaching a sermon dry as dust, or if my mind is wandering because of an endless communion liturgy, or the service itself isn't making any sense at all, the first question I ask is not, what made this person think he or she was called to ministry? The first question I ask, what's going on in my life that my heart is not prepared to worship? What is going on in my life that my heart is not prepared to worship? Now, I'm not defending lack of preparation, poor leadership, or bad theology. You can ask Jose and Melissa. I have high expectations. And you can ask Margie, none higher than those I place upon myself. But if you think any of that has anything to do with the quality of your offering of worship, I would respectfully, in Christian love, invite you to think again. Beloved, if your heart is right with God, nothing, not some boring liturgy, not some dry sermon, not some dreadful hymn. If your heart is right with God, nothing will keep you from offering your praise and thanksgiving to God with humble and joyful hearts. Nothing. For the worship God desires is a matter of your heart. Thanks be to God.